So what I want to talk about today is short-duration gamma-ray bursts and their potential relation to gravitational wave sources. And this is work that's been done in collaboration with several postdocs and graduate students and undergrads and that I'll highlight throughout the talk. So the objectives of our research on short gamma-ray bursts in particular has been driven by several key ideas. So the first one is to try to actually, I'll use the hockey stick, to try to determine the properties of a relatively poorly understood subset of gamma ray bursts and what actually is causing them, what's the energy scale, you know, the basic properties. The other one is that it's been thought for a while that short duration gamma ray bursts are caused by neutron star binary mergers. Given the short duration of the events, it makes sense that they come from a compact system. And so we actually want to test this potential association using observations that will show us whether this theoretical idea makes sense. And I'm not going to really differentiate between neutron star, neutron star, and neutron star black hole mergers in this talk, because I don't think we have any clear observational evidence pointing to one versus the other. But as I'll show you, as a type of objects, we think we now have fairly strong evidence relating these two classes of objects. And we found this particularly exciting because if we can establish this connection between short GRBs and these compact object mergers, then we can actually use the properties of short GRBs to both further our understanding of the formation and evolution of these compact objects, and to guide our future electromagnetic follow-up observations of LIGO sources. So that will be the kind of theme of the talk. Okay, so the outline is I'll provide a kind of brief overview of gamma ray bursts in general, and one of the things I'm going to highlight in particular is what all real estate agents know, that location is a critical aspect of astrophysical systems. Essentially, by studying the types of environments where these objects occur, I'll show you we can actually gain an enormous insight into what the progenitors are and what their properties are. So I'll talk about the galaxy scale environments of short GRBs and then zoom in and ask where do they actually occur within galaxies and what that tells us about the progenitors. Then I'll spend a little bit of time talking about the afterglow emission from short GRBs. This is the emission that's left after the main event is over. And actually provides most of the information about the burst. So that will tell us about the energy scale, the geometry of these events, and something about their very local environment on a scale of less than a parsec. And finally, I'll apply this knowledge to ask what can we learn from short GRBs about how to look for electromagnetic counterparts of gravitational wave sources in the LIGO era. Okay, so let me start with one slide on the basic history of gamma ray bursts, just so everybody's on the same page. So gamma ray bursts are kind of a fascinating story, and one can spend a lot of time on the history. They were discovered completely by accident in the late 1960s by Department of Defense satellites that were looking for nuclear experiments in space. And instead, they found these mysterious objects that appear to come from outside of the solar system. That lasted anywhere from about a second to maybe a few tens of seconds in gamma rays. And they've remained a mystery for the first almost 20 or 30 years after their discovery. One particularly important clue came in the early 1990s with from the BATSE experiment on the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory that localized a large sample of gamma ray bursts, about 2,700 of them. And what it showed is that they're uniformly distributed on the sky, and therefore they're unlikely to come from the Milky Way and are instead a cosmological population of sources. So that started setting an overall energy scale on the problem. But the real breakthrough came in the late 1990s when counterparts to gamma ray bursts were discovered at other wavelengths. So first at X-rays and then in optical and radio wavelengths. And that provided much more precise positions that actually allowed distance measurements showing that they really are cosmological in origin and therefore have an enormous energy scale. As I mentioned earlier, the afterglow emission, the optical X-ray radio emission, also tells us something about the geometry of the explosion, the environment in which these objects are exploding, and therefore can serve as an important clue about what the progenitor systems actually are. But the fascinating thing that came out of this is that gamma ray bursts not only are not galactic in origin, they're detectable from the very far reaches of the universe. And so some of the most distant objects that we know about in the universe are gamma ray bursts. The record holder right now is redshift of about 9.5. Okay, so these are objects that exploded only a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. So given this kind of information that comes from the afterglow, we have kind of a basic picture of how gamma ray bursts are produced. A lot of this is still a question mark, but kind of in broad brush, this is what we think is going on. So we have some sort of a progenitor system that gives rise to a black hole surrounded by an accretion disk. And that process leads to the formation of a relativistic outflow, a jet, that has instabilities that lead to internal shocks within the outflow itself. And those internal shocks are thought to produce the gamma ray emission. Okay? Now, the gamma ray emission lasts for a very short period of time, from tens of milliseconds to maybe hundreds of seconds, telling us something about the duration of the whole process. But eventually, after these internal shocks are over, we have a relatively homogeneous outflow that's flowing out and interacting with the local environment, essentially acting like a snowplow, right? It runs into the medium surrounding the progenitor system, and that produces the afterglow. Okay, so that produces the X-ray, optical, and radio emission that we see. So this is kind of like a supernova explosion, where this phase is like the supernova remnant. Only a supernova remnant takes about 100 years or longer to form. Here, this happens on a timescale of hundreds of seconds. And this afterglow then fades away on a timescale of anywhere from hours to days to weeks. Okay. So we have these three components. We have the central engine and whatever is producing the black hole. This outflow has a Lorentz factor initially of somewhere between 100 and 1,000. So this is a very clean system, very few baryons contaminating the outflow. And so that gives rise to this chaotic gamma ray emission. And then, again, we have the interaction with the local environment that produces an optical signal, an X-ray signal, and a radio signal that can last anywhere from hours to days to weeks. Now, the interesting thing is that the energy scale overall, once we correct for the fact that these explosions are not spherical, they're beamed in relatively narrow jets of a few degrees, the energy scale is actually similar to a supernova explosion. It's about 10 to the 51 ergs, or a few times 10 to the 51 ergs. The key difference between gamma ray bursts and supernovae is that in a supernova, that explosion contains several solar masses of material traveling at typical speeds of 10,000 kilometers per second. A gamma ray burst is an extremely clean explosion. The Lorentz factor is about 100, and there are about 10 to the minus 5 solar masses of ejecta. So even though the energy scale is similar, they're fundamentally different. That's right. So there's one, the long duration class of gamma ray bursts actually are caused by core collapse of massive stars, and they are accompanied by a supernova explosion. But they're essentially two decoupled processes producing those events. Okay, so the other thing that came out of these early observations is that gamma ray bursts actually have a bimodal distribution of durations. So if we just plot the duration, you can see that there are two peaks in the distribution, one centered at about half a second or so, and the other one at about a minute or so. And the dividing line is somewhere around a second between those two distributions. And so we call these the short duration gamma ray bursts that I'll focus on today, and these are the long duration gamma ray bursts. And in all other respects, there's really no difference between these two classes of objects. The only distinction is the durations. Okay, and so. There's some difference in the hardness, so the gamma ray emission from these is somewhat harder than from these, but if you actually made the same distribution for hardness, there would be much more overlapping. It's really the duration that separates them. Okay. Now, the short gamma ray bursts have been harder to localize, and so the afterglows that were discovered in 1997 and until about 2005, 2006 were all from the long burst category, and it was only about 6 or 7 years ago that we finally managed to find afterglows from short bursts. Until that point, people were still arguing about whether those are potentially a galactic population of bursts. Okay, so how do we study these? I just want to give you kind of an idea. Given that we're looking at sources that are discovered in gamma rays, but then most of the information comes from X-ray, optical, and radio observations, and they only last for a short period of time, this is quite a challenging observational problem. Give me 1 second. And so these days, the satellite that finds gamma ray bursts is mainly SWIFT. It sends information to the ground in about a minute or two on the location of the burst. And then we've been running a program at Harvard using a wide range of optical telescopes, both on the ground and in space, as well as radio telescopes to actually follow up and study these events. And this has to happen essentially in real time within a few minutes. This is the observed distribution from BATSE.
Yeah.
So at the long end, I think this is fairly clear that there's a real drop off. At the short end, this is probably selection effect, right? Because events that the way these events are detected is the satellite looks from deviation from some constant background level. So something that has a really short duration has to be extremely intense to be detected. So this drop-off is probably a selection effect. So this distribution could extend to even shorter
but
duration.
But there is no selection effect in the middle?
No, there's nothing obvious going on.
And listen, the bottom versus the triple 1 to 10, that's not numbers. What
would it be? Oh, these are fraction of events. So in the BATSE sample, about a quarter of the events were short bursts and three quarters were long bursts. In the SWIFT sample, which is the one where we're actually getting all of our information, only 1 out of 10 bursts is of the short category.
So you mean actually in the universe, one out of...
No, this is in the detected sample. As I'll show you, the because they're fainter, they're detected over a smaller volume. And actually, the volumetric rate of short GRBs is probably significantly higher than the long GRBs. But in the observed sample, they're only about 10%.
This is not predominantly
Swift. No, this is the BATSE. But you know the BATSE bursts were poorly localized, so all of our information is coming from the SWIFT. But so that essentially highlights the challenge. SWIFT finds about 100 GRBs per year, but only 10 of those per year are the short burst. So it's taken a few years to collect a sample that's large enough to figure out what's going on. Okay, so let me talk about location, why it's important. So I figured I'll start with kind of an example from Earth. Okay. So we have these two kinds of locations, and we want to understand what kind of sources exist in each one of those locations. And so you have, you know, two groups of sources, right? And I think everybody can figure out that this is not the correct association, right? You can tell just from the environment that this is the way these things are, right? So we do the same thing in astronomy. So here's a somewhat more serious example. So this is... these are distributions of supernovae of different types, rate, as a function of galaxy type, so ellipticals and different kinds of spiral galaxies. And you can see that you don't need to know anything about supernovae, right? There's type 1a, type 1bc, type 2. What you can tell immediately just from this distribution is that the type 1bc and the type 2s never happen in elliptical galaxies. They only happen in spiral galaxies that have star formation, whereas the type 1as happen in all kinds of galaxies. So what this is telling you without any other further knowledge about these supernovae is that the type 1As come from some type of old stellar population, whereas the type 2s and the 1BCs come from young stellar populations because they only exist in environments where there's active star formation. Okay? So this is a very simplistic example. Just what kind of galaxy they happen in already is giving you some very powerful information about the progenitors. So we're gonna do similar tests with gamma ray bursts to see what that tells us about the progenitors. So to set the stage, let me tell you a little bit about the environments where long GRBs exist, and then I'll use that to contrast with short GRBs. So there are three primary things that I want to mention. So the first one is that long GRBs occur exclusively in star-forming galaxies. Okay, whenever we go and study a galaxy where a long GRB happened, those galaxies are forming stars at a high rate, right? So these are some Hubble images showing that some of them look like spirals, some of them look like irregular galaxies. And the spectra show these very strong emission lines indicative of star formation. So that's clue number one, telling us that they come from the death of massive stars. Now, in addition, if we actually ask the question, where do they occur within their galaxies? You can look at two types of distributions. So the first one, you can ask, what's the distribution of distance between the burst location and the center of the galaxy? And just draw a cumulative distribution. So that's the solid histogram here. And then you can ask, how is star formation distributed within galaxies, right? The star formation is not all occurring at the centers of galaxies or just in the spiral arms. There's some distribution, and that distribution is shown in the thin line over here. And so you can see that GRBs, essentially the long GRBs, trace within their galaxies the distribution that star formation is tracing. Okay, so not only do they come from star-forming galaxies, they actually track where the star formation is taking place. Now, you can look at this in another way. You can ask, what about the specific location where the burst occurred? How much star formation is occurring in that environment? Okay, and that's what's showing in this diagram. So this diagram is a little bit complicated, but I'll come back to it with short GRBs to show you how what we can learn from it. But essentially, what this is showing is that any population that is tracking, for example, star formation in a linear fashion will essentially track this diagonal line. Okay, and so this red distribution is actually core collapse supernovae. So you can see the core collapse supernovae track the locations of star formation of UV light, essentially, one-to-one. Whereas long GRBs, which are below the line, are concentrated in particularly bright regions. So not only are they tracking star formation, they're probably tracking some specific mode of star formation. They're only occurring in the most luminous star-forming regions within their hosts. So what this is telling us is that they're probably coming from environments that have the most intense star formation, whereas core collapse supernovae come from normal star-forming regions. Now, any population that would be above this line would be uncorrelated with star formation. And we can also draw this for stellar mass or whatever parameter we want to know. So this is an important test for progenitor systems, and I'll come back to it. Yeah.
How do you know that this has a selection bias?
So this is not the brightness. So what you do is you find the gamma ray burst, right? So it's the same thing shown here. So you find a gamma ray burst, right? You localize it, and then you wait for it to fade away. And you go and you look at the galaxy, and you ask, where did it occur relative to the rest of the galaxy? And what you find is quite often, as you can see in these plots, the burst happened in the brightest region of the galaxy. Telling you that this is the areas where the most intense star formation activity is taking place. So not only are they tracking star formation, they're tracking a particular mode of star formation.
So you think the short GRBs track the most intense?
No, this is long GRBs.
So
the reason I was showing this is to contrast with short GRBs, which is what I'll talk about now. Okay, so just to set the stage, so we have a couple of progenitor systems in mind for the short GRBs. So the most popular one, as I mentioned, is the coalescence of compact objects to form a black hole with an accretion disk. And there are some expectations in this model that we can actually test. One is that there's a broad distribution of delay times between when the system was born and when it eventually merges. Okay. And that will impact the type of environments that these gamma ray bursts will happen in. So for example, imagine that you have all these systems taking 10 billion years to merge. Okay. That means that they will only occur in galaxies where star formation no longer takes place, because over a time scale of 10 billion years, star formation will have faded away. It will also mean that they will occur preferentially at very low redshifts, because if it takes 10 billion years to merge, that means that even the systems that were formed early on in the universe will only merge now in the recent history of the universe. Okay, so the broad distribution of delay times that's expected will impact the environments and the redshift distribution. So we can use that as a test. Another prediction of this model is that these systems should experience systemic velocities that are imparted at the time when the neutron stars were born. Okay, and so you can imagine that the supernova explosion, particularly the second one, can give the system a kick, maybe 10, 100 kilometers per second. And if it takes a billion years to merge, the system could travel quite a large distance from its birth site. Okay, so that's another prediction of the model. And of course, the strongest prediction and the one that we all get excited about is gravitational waves. We expect that these systems, at the same time that they produce a gamma ray burst, will also produce a burst of gravitational waves that could be detected with LIGO. Now, there's another class of objects that that are potential progenitors of short GRBs. These are giant flares from magnetars. Magnetars are young neutron stars with magnetic fields of 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 Gauss. And they're known to produce burst, the soft gamma ray repeaters in the Milky Way, that look very much like short-duration gamma ray bursts. Okay, so it's possible that the short gamma ray bursts that we see are extragalactic examples of these magnetars. Now, the predictions here are very different. These are young systems. They only maintain this very strong magnetic field for a relatively short period of time. And so they're only going to be found in young systems, and they will be found in particular in coincidence with star-forming environment, because the lifetime of the system is, thousands of years. So the star formation will still be going on. Yep.
You could have the degeneracy there because if you had a Einstein merger, you could form a Monte Carlo.
That's right. So I'm going to be agnostic about whether you actually form a black hole or a magnetar. That's fine. But I'm making the distinction between magnetars that are born directly from core collapse versus the binary merger. No, because these stars have very short lifetimes, right? These massive stars that produce neutron stars have lifetimes of, 10 or 20 million years. Yeah, yeah. So the more massive a star is, the shorter the lifetime by a strong power of the mass. Yeah. Okay. So some of these, the stars that are thought to produce the long-duration gamma ray bursts have lifetimes of only 5 million years. The 1,000-year timescale is from the formation of the neutron star, a timescale roughly that it maintains this very strong magnetic field and can produce these magnetar flares, after which it's unable to do that. Now, the other implication of this model is because these neutron stars can also get kick velocities, right, at the time they were born, but because the lifetime of the system when it can produce these flares is so short, they're not really going to travel an appreciable distance from where they were born. So these we're going to find in coincidence with star-forming environments, and these we can find anywhere. Okay, so those are the kind of tests that we're going to be looking at.
Sorry.
Yeah.
For the magnetars, this is a core collapse of this clouds or house?
Yeah, so they're formed through core collapse. So they're just like a regular neutron star, but for some reason they're born with a much stronger. So the kicks come from the fact that supernova explosions are not spherically symmetric. And so there's some momentum that's imparted to the remnant at the time when the neutron star is born. And so when we look at pulsars, for example, right, which are at least some subset of neutron stars, some of them are traveling at velocities of hundreds of kilometers per second that have to do with asymmetries in the supernova explosion.
100 kilometers?
Hundreds, yeah.
100.
Sorry?
200 kilometers to pick up for galaxies.
It's so there is a distribution of velocities anywhere from a few tens of kilometers per second up to hundreds. Yeah. Okay. All right, so let me.
You mean even the lowest mass neutron stars, they have this 10 million lifetime, they have this 10 million year lifetime?
Of the progenitor star?
Yeah.
So the lowest mass stars that can explode and leave behind a neutron star are somewhere around 8 or 10 solar masses.
Yeah.
Those probably have a lifetime of somewhere between 50 and 80 million years. But you still see, when you look at core collapse supernovae, you still see the star formation in the environment where the progenitor star was born. I mean, those lifetimes are really short. Right? The sun is 10 billion years, but it's not going to produce a supernova, of course. Okay, so early on, so the holy grail in all of this to get any of this information is to find afterglow emission, because that provides accurate localizations that allow us to associate GRBs with specific galaxies, and then we can measure the redshift and the energy scale of the environment. So I just wanted to show you, starting at the largest scales, what we can actually learn from their environments. So here are a couple of examples of short-duration gamma ray bursts. This one was localized to this environment. This circle marks the localization region. And you can see this giant elliptical galaxy within this region. And then here's another one that was localized much more precisely. So you can actually see the afterglow here. This image was taken by my group a few hours after the burst was discovered. And this one was taken 2 days later. And you can see there is this object here that disappeared 2 days later. That's the afterglow. Okay, and that's the galaxy that the burst occurred in. And both of these galaxies are elliptical galaxies with no star formation. I mean, these galaxies probably have not had any star formation for several billion years. Okay? And the redshifts are 0.23 and 0.26. So just with these two examples, already we know that gamma ray bursts are not coming from the Milky Way. They're extragalactic sources. And unlike long GRBs, which, as I mentioned, all of them occur in star-forming galaxies, here are a couple of examples of short GRBs, and you can see that they come from galaxies with no star formation. So just this clue alone already tells you that the progenitors of short GRBs are not young, massive stars. They're some sort of an old stellar population. Now, we can look at the redshift distribution. As I mentioned, the redshift distribution tells us something about the age of the progenitors. So we can measure the redshifts of these galaxies, and we can translate redshift to to time scale. And then we can look at models of star formation. Okay, so for example, if you had sources that track star formation with no delay, they would have some redshift distribution. And then if you add a delay, you push the redshifts of the population to systematically lower and lower numbers. So by comparing the redshifts that we find to models with different delays, we find that the typical age of the progenitors is less than 3 billion years. So they're an old population, but they're not particularly old. They're not 10 billion year old systems. Okay. Now, if we can demonstrate that short GRBs have to do with neutron star binaries, that's giving us some sort of a clue about neutron star binary merger timescales. Okay, that typically it takes the system from the time it was born to the point of merger less than about 3 billion years. Now, we can actually ask, okay, so what's the distribution of galaxies that they occur in? So some of them, as I mentioned, happen in elliptical galaxies. Some of them actually, in fact, almost half of them actually do happen in galaxies with star formation. Okay, they're not all in these old elliptical galaxies. And some of them have no galaxies at all coincident with them. I'll come back to these because I think these are potentially the most interesting. But just this little pie chart is actually telling us something very interesting. So if we have a population of sources that whose rate is only related to stellar mass, so the more stars there are, the more there is of this population of sources, we would expect to find roughly half of them in elliptical galaxies and half of them in star-forming galaxies, because that's how stellar mass is distributed in the universe. The fact that we find most short GRBs in star-forming galaxies rather than elliptical galaxies is telling us, yes, their progenitors are old. They're older than massive stars, but they're actually not that old. They're still somehow tracking star formation activity. Okay? Instead of a delay of 10 or 50 million years, it's maybe a few hundred million years, but they are influenced by star formation. That means that quite a few of these systems, if they're neutron star binaries, are merging pretty rapidly within a few hundred million years of when the system was born. Okay? So that's, again, another interesting clue about the progenitors. Let me skip that. So in fact, we can take a step forward and we can say, instead of just asking whether the galaxy is old or young, let's actually look at the age of the stars in the galaxy. And it's something we can measure from the observations. And we can just have a distribution of the age of the stellar population in each galaxy. And we can say if the progenitor of the short GRB in each galaxy was formed at the same time as the bulk of the stars in the galaxy, then we know the age of the progenitor. And by putting a lot of them together, we know the distribution of ages. And so that's what's shown in the black histogram. And essentially what it's telling us is that the typical age for the progenitors, whatever they are, is about 300 million years in star-forming galaxies, and it's about 3 billion years in elliptical galaxies. Now, if we do the same thing for long GRBs, we ask what is the age of the stellar populations. That's the gray histogram here in the background. And the typical age is something like 50 or 60 million years. So long GRBs, which come from massive stars, occur very quickly after the stars are born. Right? The stars are born, and then within 50 million years, some of them start exploding as long GRBs. Short GRBs have a delay of about 300 million years up to several giga-year from the point of star formation to when they occur.
0.3 giga-years sounds smaller than what I would imagine if they're emerging, if they were produced by mergers, just because if you imagine they're born with any sort of relatively uniform distribution of initial semi-major axis, then the time of merger is a steep function of the original semi-major axis.
Yeah, so I think what this is telling us, and actually that's not in disagreement with the merger timescale distribution for neutron star binaries in the Milky Way. In the Milky Way, we have at least one system that will merge within about 100 million years. And of course, the fact that we see one means that quite a few of them have already merged. So they actually dominate the rate. So,
yeah. There's a strong selection effect that when you make the double neutron star binary, I thought common envelope evolution was a necessary ingredient to tightly enough bind the binary prior to the second circuit of the supernova. So you necessarily have very tight binary.
So I'll come back to this in a second. I mean, in the Milky Way, we know of about 7 or 8 neutron star binaries. And we can make a similar age distribution based on those. And it seems to at least follow a distribution that's like where the merger timescale goes like timescale to the minus 1. Look at the probability. So they're actually quite, there's a, so we actually form quite a few. Yeah. So actually form, quite a few. And I think it's related to what Avery's saying, that that you actually preferentially form these things with relatively small separations. Now, of course, if you don't, then the time scale to merge is hundreds of billions of years, and those will never merge. Right. But I think, you know, as I'll show you in the next few slides, I think we actually have quite strong evidence that these are really neutron star binaries. So what this is essentially telling us is that, yes, some of these, or the majority of these neutron star binaries are actually merging quite rapidly within a few hundred million years of when the system was born. Now, there are models out there that take this common envelope evolution to the extreme and claim that for the majority of them, the merger timescale is only 10 million years. That we, you know, the data do not agree with that kind of an extreme case. But it does seem to take only a few hundred million years. Okay, so just based on looking at the galaxy scale environment, just asking what kind of galaxies they happen in, what's the age of the stellar population, we already gained some important insight about the progenitors. So they're an evolved stellar population. They're not young, massive stars. They have a rate of occurrence that depends on both the stellar mass and the star formation of the galaxy. That's actually very similar to type 1a supernovae. And the typical time scale to merge is somewhere between a few hundred million years to a few billion years. And as I mentioned, that's broadly in agreement with a galactic population of neutron star binaries that have a merger timescale distribution that goes like tau to the minus one, roughly. Okay. So as we continue to increase the sample, we're actually now have a sample. Now in the Milky Way, we know of something like 7 or 8 neutron star binaries. Our short GRB sample is now tens of objects and will eventually be hundreds of objects. So we can actually learn more about neutron star binary evolution from by using short GRBs rather than the actual systems that we can see in the Milky Way. So that's on a galactic scale. Now let's go and ask, where do they actually occur within their galaxies? And the reason we want to do that is in particular to see if we have any indication for these kicks. Right? So if a typical kick is, let's say, 50 kilometers per second, and it takes a few hundred million years for the system to merge, it can actually travel quite a large distance, you know, anywhere between a few and 10 kiloparsecs or tens of kiloparsecs away from the galaxy. So we should see that effect in the data. So the way we do this is we actually go to the Hubble Space Telescope, and we precisely locate the position of these short GRBs relative to their galaxies. So that's what's shown here. Each image is a particular galaxy where a short GRB occurred, and the red circle marks the position of the burst. And so you can see that we can locate them quite precisely. And let's see what we find for the distribution of objects. So the first thing I want to mention before I show you the distribution is these subset of events that I mentioned earlier, about a quarter of all the short GRBs that completely lack galaxies at the position of the burst. So here you can see that there are galaxies nearby, but then we have some events where we go and take these Hubble images, and there is absolutely nothing. So this marks the position of the burst. Of course, it faded away when we took the image. You can see there's no galaxy here. Right? Here is another one. There's no galaxy. There are other galaxies nearby, but there's no galaxy at the position of the burst. So that's quite interesting, because those might be the ones that are kicked by a very large distance from a galaxy. So maybe the reason there's no galaxy here is because the GRB came from this galaxy, and the system traveled all the way here before it exploded. Okay, so that would be quite interesting. Yeah, so I'll show that in a second. Okay. But the first thing is how do we actually make that statement? How can we test whether there is really an association with these nearby galaxies? So the way to do it is basic statistics. Okay, so what we do is we say, okay, let's go from the position of the burst to each one of these galaxies. And for each one, we can measure, right? We can put a circle with some area. And we can ask, what is the probability of finding a galaxy of this brightness within this area on the sky? Okay, so we know from just looking at images that there are more faint galaxies in images than there are bright galaxies, right? So, for example, there are more of these little faint blobs. You can just see it on the image than there is something as bright as this. But for each one of them, we can just ask, what is the probability? Right? So that probability is a product of the area that we're searching. The further out we go, the bigger the area that we search, and the number density of galaxies, how many galaxies there are per unit area on the sky of a given brightness. Okay. And so it's just simple statistics. So when we do that and we add up the probabilities in all the fields, what we find is the following. So there are no galaxies at separations less than about 1 arcsecond. That's because there are no galaxies at the positions of the bursts. You can see that as you go out, there is, you know, you find galaxies, but their probability of being there by chance is 10%, you know, not surprising. And as you go really far out, again, you find 10, 20, 30%. So those are just there by accident. Any image that you take will have those galaxies. But then there is this separation of about 10 arcseconds where there are galaxies that should not be there by chance. So very low probability of, that these galaxies are there by pure coincidence. I mean, this distribution should just be flat across all separations. Now, you can say, well, maybe this has nothing to do with short GRBs. Maybe there's something about galaxies and the way they cluster on the sky or something like that. So we can actually test this with the GRBs that have coincident galaxies. So here you can see there's very low probability for these galaxies that are right at the position of the burst. And then all the other galaxies, you don't see any excess probability of being there. So what this is telling you is that for these particular fields where we don't see a galaxy at the position of the GRB itself, there's always some other galaxy that should not be there by chance at a rough separation of anywhere between a few to 20 arcseconds. And at the redshifts that we're talking about, these are separations of somewhere between 50 and 100 kiloparsecs. Okay? So essentially what this is telling us is that these bursts that lack galaxies right at the position of the burst is because they have traveled distances of anywhere between 50 to 100 kiloparsecs from their the galaxies where they were born before the explosion took place. Okay? And really the only progenitor system that should be able to do that is a neutron star binary or a neutron star black hole binary.
Is there a certain type of galaxy are these hostless galaxies? Are these all tiny little galaxies?
No, they're actually, so for example, in this example that I showed here, it's this galaxy over here. It's a reasonably bright spiral. Some of them are elliptical galaxies. I mean, in their properties, they're actually very similar to the ones that are coincident in position.
Okay.
So magnetars, right? So think about, so magnetars are will also have these large velocities, but the lifetime of the magnetar stage in the evolution of the neutron star is only a few thousand years. So there's no way it can get to a distance of 50 kiloparsecs. At these velocities, to get to 50 kiloparsecs takes a few hundred million years to a few billion years. Okay. So it's a combination of the duration of the system and the velocity. I think a typical velocity probably that you're finding here is something like anywhere between 30 to 50 and up to a couple hundred. So these are not unusually large velocities.
Okay. I don't know, sorry, this is a few hundred, this is a few times 10 to the 5 years over 300 million years.
Yeah, maybe up to a few billion years. Yeah. So these velocities are actually, so. So let me show you the distribution for the whole population. And I think that will answer some of this. Okay, so this is, if we take our population, both the ones with coincident galaxies and without, and we just ask how far away are the GRBs from the galaxies, we get this red curve, this red histogram. Okay, so it goes anywhere from about a kiloparsec, so there's at least some of them that are close to the center, up to about, you know, 100 kiloparsecs for the ones that are really far out. Now, the long GRBs are shown here in black. So clearly, these short GRBs have a much larger distribution around their galaxies than the long GRBs. But what's really fascinating, I think, is that these gray curves are models from population synthesis, various population synthesis codes, taking neutron star binaries and actually evolving them with a distribution of kick velocities, with a distribution of merger timescales, and just making predictions for what the distribution of locations is at the time of the merger. Okay, now all of these models were on the market well before we did any of these observations. Okay, so this is not a fit to the data. But you can see that it's actually quite a remarkable agreement between these predictions of where these neutron star binaries should be located when they merge and when short GRBs actually are located relative to their galaxies.
The reason I'm saying it is because can't you basically not get, I think if you merge two neutron stars,
Well, no, no, this is not the kick velocity when they merge. This is the kick velocity when the system was born.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
right? Because after the merger, we don't know what happened. Yeah, yeah. So, So I think this is to me, that's quite amazing that these two things agree so well. So what this is telling us is that short GRBs are located around their galaxies where neutron star binaries should be located around their galaxies. Okay, so I think that's a pretty powerful clue that they really are the same thing. Now, we can see this in another way, and you can actually see it from the images. You can ask, so this is this diagram that I showed earlier, where objects along the line are correlated one-to-one with whatever property you want, star formation, stellar mass. Objects below the line, like short GRBs, are particularly strongly correlated with the brightest regions. And anything above the line is weakly correlated. Okay? So, and you can see from the images, for example, you can see that this is where all the stars are in this galaxy, and this is where the short GRB is located. Okay? Here's a different example. This is where the stars are, and the short GRB is actually located very close to them. So you can ask, what is the distribution? Where are the short GRBs located relative to where the stars are? And you get this red line over here. So what this is essentially telling you is that short GRBs and stars are not located in the same place. Okay? Sometimes they are, but quite often they're not. Now, any system that has not traveled from where it was born should be correlated with where the stellar mass of the galaxy is. If environments have more stars, should have more of those systems, right? Mm-hmm. So the fact that they're not correlated is telling us that the progenitors have had to travel away from where they were born. Okay, so this is essentially a different way of looking at this issue of kicks. It's telling us that even the ones that are not far away from their galaxies, they're not 50 kiloparsecs away or 100 kiloparsecs away, they're only a few kiloparsecs away, are still in an environment where there are no stars. So how did they get there? They had to be born in some other part of the galaxy and gotten kicked to their present location where they explored it. Okay? So what all of this is telling us essentially is that the progenitors of short GRBs are systems that travel at velocities of tens to maybe even hundreds of kilometers per second, and neutron star binaries naturally explain this. Okay, so I think this is really this issue of looking at what type of environments short GRBs occur in is actually giving us the strongest clues of what the progenitors are, and they seem to be neutron star black hole binaries. Okay, so let me move on from talking about environments to what we can actually now learn about the energy scale. Okay, so here are two examples of short GRB afterglows now. So what I'm showing here is brightness as a function of frequency. So this is radio, optical over here, and X-rays over here. So these are this is the emission from the afterglow itself. And based on this emission, we can actually extract quite a lot of information. So by fitting this is just pure synchrotron emission. By fitting the shape of the spectrum, we can extract properties like the energy of the explosion, the density of the environment into which the explosion is proceeding. And if we can actually track the evolution as a function of time, we can say something about the geometry. Okay, so what we find from this particular event is that the energy is a few times 10 to the 50 ergs. And the density of the environment is low. It's something like 10 to the minus 2 or 0.1 particles per cubic centimeter. And the typical density of the interstellar medium is about 1 particle per cubic centimeter. So what this is telling us is that around, on the scale of about a parsec, around the progenitor system, the density is well below the typical interstellar medium density. So this is an independent evidence for the fact that these objects are not exploding inside their galaxies. They're exploding somewhere in the halo of the galaxy. Not interstellar medium. So this is for one, for this particular GRB, and this is for another GRB. So these are two different. These are both short, yeah. So here, we actually have some better information. We can actually measure the opening angle of the jet. And it's about 7 degrees or so. So when we correct for that beaming, we find that the energy is actually quite low. It's only 10 to the 49 ergs. Remember, the typical energy for a long GRB is about 10 to the 51 ergs. So this is about 100 times less energy in the system. But again, we find a very low density, 10 to the minus 3 particles per cubic centimeter. So these events are, again, not exploding in the dense interstellar medium of their galaxies. They're exploding pretty far out.
So you do the same exercise for the long GRBs, the density you get?
The densities are generally higher than the typical interstellar medium density. They're somewhere around 10 particles per cubic centimeter. And the reason is that their local environment is actually influenced by mass loss from the progenitor star, right? So they occur in particularly dense environments. And that's the reason their afterglows are so much brighter and easier to find. Yes?
How do you measure density? Density margin.
So think about it this way. Essentially, what is happening is you have this this blast wave that's expanding outward into the local environment. And the emission that we see, the synchrotron emission, comes from particles that get accelerated in the shock that forms with the environment. So the more particles you have, the denser the environment, the brighter this emission is going to be. Okay? So essentially, it's the combination of this, the shape of the spectrum and its overall normalization that give us both the energy and the density. So what we need to do in order to make these measurements is we have to make observations all the way from radio to x-rays. Otherwise, we get degeneracies in the model and we can't determine any of these parameters. But essentially, to first order, essentially the brightness tells you about the density.
You have to assume the magnetic field. That's
right. So what we usually assume is that the magnetic field is something like 1% of equipartition or something like that. I mean, you can scale it. It will move the density up and down. But if you want to get these densities, these low densities, up to typical interstellar medium densities, you have to have essentially efficiency of greater than 100% of producing magnetic fields, which is not going to happen. So those were just two examples. We have observations of a much larger sample now, something like 30 objects. And we can actually take this aggregate. So these are, for example, radio observations. And you can see that most of them are non-detections. But those upper limits give us some bound on the typical density. And what we find that on average, the density is something like 10 to the minus 2 particles per cubic centimeter. So again, this is well below the density of the interstellar medium of these galaxies. So another independent clue that the progenitors are live in low density environments. Now, one particular question that we're interested in is the geometry, the opening angle of the jet. And the reason is that it has two important effects. One is that the narrower the jets are, the lower the energy scale that's required. And the other one is that the narrower the jets are, the larger is the number of actual, the higher is the rate compared to what we observed. Right? So those go in the opposite directions. So the way we measure the geometry is from looking at the afterglow evolution. And we look for things like this, where there is a sudden steepening in the evolution of the afterglow. Okay, that is an indication of the opening angle of the jet. The earlier this happens, the narrower the jet is. And if I'm not going to explain this right now, you can ask me later why that is. So we now have several cases where we see this. And essentially what this is telling us is that the typical opening angle is something like 5 to 10 degrees, which means that the corrected energies are somewhere in the range typically of 10 to the 48 to 10 to the 49. For this relativistic jet that comes out of the GRB. What it's also telling us is that the rate that we observe, so now this comes back to the volumetric rate. So this is the volumetric observed rate of short GRBs, 10 per gigaparsec cube per year, has to be corrected upward by a factor of about 100 because we only see one out of 100 GRBs that happens to be pointed at us. So if we translate this to what is the expected rate of short GRBs within the volume that advanced LIGO will be sensitive to, we find something like 30 per year, which is really nice because the expected rate for neutron star binary mergers within this volume is something like 40 per year. So those are in nice agreement, again, suggesting that there is a relation between these systems. Now, the rate of long GRBs, the observed rate is much higher than short GRBs, but the actual volumetric rate of long GRBs is about 20 times lower than the volumetric rate. They're just so much brighter that we can see them over a much bigger volume of the universe. Okay. But I think this is quite reassuring that independent of estimating neutron star binary merger rates from in anticipation of LIGO, the short GRBs are telling us that we will expect a rate of about 30 per year. Oh, they were looking at such a small volume that there's no tension there. Yeah. I think the upper bound is at least several hundred per year within the same volume. So we're still comfortably below that. Yeah. Okay, so hopefully by now you're fairly convinced that short GRBs actually have something to do with neutron star binary mergers, and that we actually have a fairly decent understanding on the energy scale, the density of the environment and beaming, that putting this together will allow us to say something about what the electromagnetic counterparts of LIGO sources will actually look like. So that's what I want to turn to for the last few minutes of the talk. Okay, so LIGO, which operated and reached design sensitivity, was capable of detecting neutron star binary mergers to about 20 megaparsecs. And within that volume, the rate of anticipated rate of neutron star binaries is substantially below the limit on the rate that LIGO put on it. But advanced LIGO has about 10 times better sensitivity, so it will see 10 times further and 1,000 times the volume. And the anticipated rate is somewhere in the range of a few to a few hundred mergers per year. As I showed you, from the rate of short GRBs, we anticipate a merger rate of about 30 or so per year that LIGO will detect. Now, LIGO can find these objects independent of their gamma ray emission, and we'll just find the gravitational wave signal from these merging neutron star binaries, and we'll provide triggers. What's interesting is that if we have a short GRB as a trigger for LIGO, then it can actually push this detection distance out to about 500 megaparsecs, because we actually have a timestamp that tells us where in the data stream to look for the gravitational wave trigger. And these systems are also face-on systems, so they have a higher signal-to-noise ratio. So in principle, for triggered searches of gravitational waves from a short GRB, the volume that one can detect is larger. But in any case, what I'm going to talk about next is just LIGO giving us triggers and what we can learn from short GRBs about the counterparts. Okay, so to begin with, why do we care about finding electromagnetic counterparts to these gravitational wave sources? I mean, the gravitational wave data will give us enormous insight into the neutron star binaries themselves, into the things like the equation of state of neutron star of neutron stars. So why do we care about finding electromagnetic counterparts? Well, I think there are three primary reasons. One is that by finding an electromagnetic counterpart, we can actually measure the distance to the system, and that will provide an overall energy scale for the whole process. Okay, from the LIGO data itself, we don't know the distance to the binary. The other one is astrophysical context. LIGO can detect these sources, but it cannot precisely locate them to a specific galaxy. Okay? By finding an electromagnetic counterpart, we can precisely locate these objects, as I showed you for short GRBs, and we can say something about what kind of environments they come from, what kind of binary formation channels are possible for these systems, etc. So it's giving us the astrophysical context for the whole system. And finally, LIGO, of course, detects gravitational waves, but it doesn't tell us about what happens to matter after the merger has occurred, about the formation of jets, about ejected material, about the hydrodynamics, right? All of that will come from electromagnetic observations. So if we really want a complete picture of how the binary formed, how it merged, and what happened after the merger, we want to combine the gravitational wave information with electromagnetic information. Okay, so that's easier said than done, of course. There are a wide range of possible electromagnetic counterparts. One is, if we look on axis, we should see a short gamma ray burst. But the question is, what happens when we look off axis, which is going to be 99 times out of 100? What are we going to see? And the challenge is that LIGO will, of course, detect these sources, but it cannot localize them very accurately. So it will tell us somewhere on a scale of 100 square degrees on the sky where these sources are going to be located. And the question is, how do we go and find an electromagnetic counterpart? It's kind of a million-dollar question right now. So let me go through just a couple of potential counterparts in the gamma rays and in the optical. Okay, so in the gamma rays, it's obvious. I mean, I spent this entire talk telling you that if we look at one of these mergers on axis, we will see a short gamma ray burst. But I also told you that this only happens 1% of the time. So we can just ask, if we had a gamma ray satellite that was monitoring the whole sky all the time, how often would you see a LIGO source, a LIGO detection, and a gamma ray burst at the same time? Which will then tell you that gamma ray bursts are definitively associated with neutron star binaries. Okay? And we can do that from the redshift distribution of the short gamma ray bursts. We can estimate that and scale it up to all sky, because the redshift distribution we have comes from Swift, which only sees about 15% of the sky at any given time. So we just scale that up. And we ask, within the horizon of advanced LIGO, how many detections per year? And it's something like 0.2 or 0.3. So that means that only once every 3 to 5 years, we're going to be in that lucky coincidence where we see a LIGO trigger and a short duration gamma ray burst happening at the same time. Okay, so that's fantastic. When we get those, they will tell us that the two are related. But we cannot use this as an electromagnetic counterpart for every single case. It will only happen once every several years. So we need something else. Okay, so what about optical emission? Well, we have the optical afterglow, and we know how bright the optical afterglows of short GRBs are, so we can use that to ask how bright would the optical afterglows look like from neutron star binary mergers. If they're on axis, it's very easy. They're extremely bright, and so these are the sensitivity limits of different kinds of facilities, and you can see that they lie somewhere between the green curve and the yellow curve. Those are detected for, you know, up to a couple of weeks. Yeah.
And then if you saw one of the hundreds, that would correspond to this one every three years.
That's right.
But then you subsequently said you can see a larger volume if you triggered.
If your trigger came from a short GRB first, then you're already on axis, right? Then you can see further out. But essentially, what this previous diagram.
So how much further do you see there?
It's about a factor of 2.5 times. That's right, if you trigger them from a short GRB, But this is just asking the question, we start with a LIGO trigger, what do we get? Okay, so the optical afterglows, if it's on axis, they're gonna be really bright, they're gonna be detectable for many days, it's gonna be reasonably straightforward to detect them, even if you have to search an area of 100 square degrees. But again, as we said, this is only gonna happen a small fraction of the time. What happens if we move away from the axis of the jet? Okay, so what is shown here is these same curves that describe the optical afterglows on axis have now been calculated for viewing them at twice the opening angle away from the jet, from the center of the jet. Okay, so you can see that instead of just being really bright and continuously fading, they first rise up. That's the time scale it takes for the jet to expand and come into our line of sight, and then they eventually fade away. But the other effect that happens is that they're now significantly fainter when they're viewed off axis. In fact, they're faint enough that the only way to find them will be with something like the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which has not even been built yet and will probably not start operating until the early 2020s. And if we go even further away from twice the opening angle, then it's hopeless. There's just no way to detect them. They're too faint. So twice the away from the opening angle is more or less our limit, and that means that that's about 10% of the events. So we buy another factor of 10 by being able to see the optical emission a little bit further away from the axis of the jet, but it's still maybe 10% of the events could be detectable this way. So we need something else. We need something that is potentially not a beamed component of the emission, something that is isotropic that we can see from all directions. And people have been talking about this for a while. So there's this concept of kilonovae. So the idea is that during the merger process itself, in addition to this relativistic jet that produces the gamma ray burst, there's going to be some component of ejected material at much lower velocities, but much more isotropic, that will either come from these tidal tails or from outflows from the accretion disk. And that material should be, of course, neutron rich, and will decompress and form our process radioactive elements. And when those radioactive elements decay on a wide range of timescales, they will produce optical emission. And that's essentially what a supernova is, right? In a supernova, the source of optical emission is radioactive decay of nickel 56. Here, it's going to be radioactive decay of these exotic R process elements. But it will produce kind of a faster, dimmer version of a supernova. So instead of lasting days to weeks, it will only last for about a day, and the luminosity will be about 100 times less than a supernova. But this signal will be isotropic, so potentially can be seen from all directions. So right now, this is what a lot of focus is going after, how to find these kind of counterparts. Now, one recent challenge in all of this is that people have started calculating what the spectrum will actually look like for these for these sources. And it turns out that these R process elements produce very strong opacities in the optical part of the spectrum. And so you can see that the optical emission is very strongly suppressed, and these sources are going to be bright in the infrared. Now, the difficulty is that in the infrared, we don't have wide-field telescopes that can search 100 square degrees. So there's a bit of a conundrum here of how to find these sources. So one possibility is to just focus here on the reddest part of the optical band, where we have wide-field telescopes, to try to find this. So the last thing I want to show you is a project we carried out last month to actually see if we can do this. Okay, so this was essentially the first dry run for doing a LIGO electromagnetic search in the optical. So essentially what we did is to ask, well, these things are only going to last for a few days, and we need to search 100 square degrees to some depth at 200 megaparsecs to find them. So let's design a survey that's capable of doing that. And the reason we want to do it is, of course, we don't have a LIGO trigger to go after, but we can figure out when we search this kind of area to that kind of depth on this timescale what all the contamination is going to be, right? Because there are going to be other transient sources, other variable stars. So we designed a survey with a dark energy camera on the 4-meter telescope at CTIO that simulated what an advanced LIGO optical counterpart search will do. So we spent a whole week at the telescope observing 100 square degrees again and again and again to figure out the contamination. And as I mentioned, we just finished this a couple of weeks ago, so I don't have the actual results to show you. But this will be the first test on how to actually determine how much contamination there is in order to find these counterparts.
Just this number of a few hundred square degrees, I mean, that's the minimum you have to look at if you want to see one of these guys.
Well, it's the typical localization region of a LIGO trigger.
Oh.
So when LIGO tells us, you know, here's a neutron star binary merger, they'll give us an area of the sky that's roughly 100 square degrees in size that we have to search. Okay, so we chose this, we chose a random area, essentially it doesn't matter because we're not doing a real follow-up. So we centered on one kind of very poor galaxy cluster and one richer galaxy cluster, and we just imaged at these two boxes on the sky repeatedly for a whole week. And now we will see how much contamination we have to contend with when we search 100 square degrees. So we really are taking the first steps in understanding what the challenge is in finding these electromagnetic counterparts. And my personal feeling is that it's going to be quite challenging, but perhaps not impossible. All right, so let me just summarize. I showed you that short GRBs, the progenitors of short GRBs, are an evolved population of stars. They're not massive stars like the long GRBs. They have a mix of galaxy types and a wide range of ages, all the way from a few hundred million years to a few billion years. The local environments of short GRBs show offsets of anywhere between a few to tens of kiloparsecs from their galaxies. They're not correlated with stellar mass or with star formation, which is, again, indicative of these kicks. And on a parsec scale around the progenitors themselves, the densities are quite low, which, again, points to kicks away from the birth site. They have a lower energy scale than long GRBs by about a factor of 100. So any merger model that people do and try to produce jets, essentially they need to produce something like 10 to the 49 ergs, maybe up to 10 to the 50 ergs in these relativistic jets. And finally, we can actually use short GRBs to guide our future searches for electromagnetic counterpart of gravitational wave sources. And one possibility is to look for the gamma ray emission, which will tell us in a very direct way whether short GRBs really are neutron star binary mergers, but will only happen once every several years. And the other one is to look in the optical, either for an off-axis emission from the jet or from this supernova-like counterpart, and we really are taking the first steps in understanding how easy or difficult this is going to be. All right, so I'll stop there. That's a good question. I mean, I think from the point of view of an observer, that delay is essentially zero, right? They should be essentially coincident. In detail, there's a question of from the time of the actual merger until the formation of a relativistic jet, there could be some delay of tens of milliseconds. I don't think we'll see that in the data, but it's potentially there. And in particular, you can think about what happens after the merger. So you start with these two roughly 1.5 solar mass neutron stars, you can imagine that you don't directly go to a black hole. You know, following the merger, that you have a, some sort of a hypermassive neutron star that then collapses after maybe a tenth of a second to a black hole. So you can build a certain delay between the gravitational wave or the end of the merger and the beginning of the gamma ray burst, but it's not something that I think will be easy to observe. Okay, but so from the point of view of the observations, they essentially happen simultaneously. For the optical counterpart, so this kilonova thing, there is some delay because initially this region that contains all this ejected material is optically thick and we can't see any radiation from it. So it takes about a day for the radiation to leak out. And so that's the delay between the gravitational wave signal and when we will start to see the optical emission is about a day. And then it will last for a few days and fade away.
There's a principle of some delay in the gravitational waves could be detected before the merger.
That's right.
Actually, that was one of my questions. So how long does it take to get feedback from LIGO for a GW triggered source?
So it really depends on the signal-to-noise ratio because the way the detections are made is by matching templates, right? So the more cycles you have, the more your signal-to-noise grows. So you start detecting the signal at some period of time, and it might take several minutes to build up enough signal-to-noise, maybe 10 or 15 minutes. Then there is some amount of time of figuring out what you saw and sending out the information. That could be, I think the goal is to get that down to minutes. Okay, so there could be some delay, but the hope right now is that that delay has to be less, definitely less than days. Because if it takes several days for LIGO to say, hey, we saw something over here, it's too late to do any follow-up, right? So, so we need that information within, let's say, half an hour or an hour or something like that. But I think that that will be doable. So radio follow-up of LIGO sources.
Yeah.
So yeah, I left that off. So so in the radio, there is one advantage, which is that you can think about this jet, right? So it starts collimated, and if you're on axis, you see the gamma rays. Then it starts spreading out. And even if you're off axis, you see optical emission. But if you're too far off axis, it's too dim. Eventually, it spreads out and becomes more or less spherical. And actually, the time scale when it becomes spherical is when the peak of the emission shifts to the radio. So in principle, radio is a fantastic way of finding these things. The problem is, as I showed you, the densities are really low around these sources. And at these low densities, the strength of the signal is much below the capability of existing instruments. So in my mind, radio is not going to be the way to look. Now, there are people who dispute this and say that radio is the best place to look. Again, based on the fact that the radio emission can be viewed from any direction. But I think they've not really accounted for the fact that the densities are so low that the strength of the signal is
from,
because we see the ones that are on axis.
Okay.
On axis, the emission is always much stronger than it is off axis.
Even in radio?
Yes.
Okay.
So if you do the calculation for what the radio emission looks like off axis, the typical brightness level is something like a microjansky or 10 microjanskys. I don't know if that means much to people, but that's well below the ability of radio telescopes to detect. And radio telescopes, right now, the existing radio telescopes, none of them have a wide field of view that can look at 100 square degrees. That's the other challenge. So I think radio in principle sounds great, but in reality probably will not work.
So this nice thing where once you see a GRB, you can go back and look in the LIGO data after the fact.
No, so
how distinctive are they? That's what I'm wondering. If you just look randomly at the patch of the sky and you see something that's consistent with the kilonova, can you say that that's what it is, or are there a million things?
So that's an excellent question. So there are two aspects to this. One is that we've never actually seen anything that looks like this, like these predictions, which may not be surprising. One is the rate of these events. If you're just looking for them blindly with no LIGO triggers. The rate of these mergers is still about 100 times less than the supernova rate.
Right.
And they're also fainter than supernova. So when you do a supernova survey, maybe one out of 10,000 supernovae that you'll discover will be one of these objects. But our surveys are not in that scale yet that we can start probing this population. So we haven't seen them yet, which means that either they don't exist or, you know, it's just we haven't done a big enough survey. How distinctive they are is a good question. If these calculation of the R process opacities are correct, then they're actually quite distinctive.
I guess if you haven't seen them
But yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I think you know, the hope is, you know, we're doing these large optical surveys to look for supernovae anyway, and eventually we might get lucky and see something like a kilonova, and then we can figure it out. They're always going to be, the thing is that gamma ray bursts are very easy to find because they're so bright and the gamma ray sky is so quiet that they just pop out like a sore thumb. These kilonovae on their own without a LIGO trigger are kind of a 1 in 10,000 event, so they don't stand out as distinctively as gamma ray bursts.
So
that's right. I mean, the only way to do this kind of survey, I mean, essentially that's what LSST will do. But it's still about a decade away. Right now, none of the existing surveys are of the scale to find these sources. They're just not, we're not looking at enough sky area fast enough, deep enough.
Now, LSST would do what exactly? It would look at the whole
space? Well, LSST will do something like several thousand square degrees per night. To a depth that is good enough to see these events out to 200 or 300 megaparsecs. Okay, so then you have a big enough volume. But the existing surveys only look at a few tens of square degrees per night, and they're too shallow to really detect these objects. So it's unfortunate, but it really shows you the scale of the challenge that you need to build a facility that costs $300 million to find these things, either LIGO or LSST. It's expensive.
Question about this star formation scenarios. From the star formation scenarios, you can get the rate of the supernovas, the rate of the neutron stars that you can generate, and also binary neutron stars. Is there any comparison between your data, the rate of events that you get from your data, considering selecting, and
yeah, so essentially that's what, when people do population synthesis models, essentially that's what they do. They take a large population of, they start with a large population of stars and they evolve them, including binaries. And then they ask the question, how many neutron star binaries do you form? What is the time scale for these binaries to merge? And that's essentially how LIGO, that's one way that LIGO is getting its expected event rate, is from these population synthesis models. The range of uncertainty in these models is about a factor of 100. Perhaps even more. The other way that LIGO gets its expected rate is by looking at the galactic population of neutron star binaries, of which, as I said, there are about 7, and ask, you know, if those are representative, you know, what's the rate going to be? That also has a factor of 100 uncertainty. Those two regions of factor of 100 uncertainty overlap, and they also overlap with the rate of short GRBs. So all these things overlap in the right way, but each one has its own associated large uncertainty. So it's not that we can get more information from models of star formation, because we don't really know, we don't have enough information about things like common envelope evolution to know what fraction of binaries that may start far apart actually get pulled close together during the common envelope phase. Right? And that has a huge impact. If you change your common envelope prescription in these models, you can take the rate up or down by a factor of 100 easily, just with this one knob in the model. There's the mass loss prescription, which will also impact whether you form a neutron star or a black hole at the end of the process. Yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty in these models. So to some extent, LIGO will actually shed some light on this, because at the very least, LIGO will tell us what the rate is, right? And that will start constraining the population synthesis models. But from first principles, it's just too messy to get a better handle on the rates than what we know now. But it's reassuring that all of it is in the right ballpark.
That you mentioned at some point that you will not distinguish between neutron star and neutron star and neutron star black hole.
Yeah.
However, in the, on the one hand, for the astrophilos, there is quite a big difference, right? If you have parallel disruption between neutron star and black hole, neutron star and black hole. And on the other hand, you would have precise information from light.
So Yeah, so that's a good question. So I think just by looking at short GRBs, I mean, it's one of the things we've been looking for. If we could find any bimodal distribution in our data, any aspect of the data, the brightness of the afterglows, the kind of galaxies that would say, oh, these come from neutron star, these come from neutron star black holes, they'll be fantastic. But we don't see anything like that in the data. And that's the reason I said I'm not going to distinguish between those two, because it's also not obvious to me what the difference is expected to be. Right now, from the gravitational wave side, you should be able to distinguish between those. And then you can go and ask the question, if I already know which ones are neutron star, which ones are neutron star black hole, and now I go and I do my optical follow-up, you know, maybe I'll start seeing some difference between the two populations. But right now, from the point of view of short GRBs, they can be all neutron star, or they can be all neutron star black holes, and we just don't know the difference. There's nothing in the, there's no clear guidance from theory that tells us what the expected difference is. Yeah, I mean, it could mean that both systems produce similar jets, or it could mean that we're just seeing the neutron star mergers, and we're not seeing any neutron star black holes in our sample. Yeah, who knows? But you know, I've been harassing a lot of theorists to actually tell me what is an expected difference between the outcome of these mergers when it comes to producing a relativistic jet. You know, is one always going to be much more energetic than the other, or do they kind of span the same range of energies? Or are they going to have very different kick velocities, or are they more or less the same? So if we had some guidance, I think we can start looking at the data to look for bimodalities. But right now, we don't see anything.
Well, yeah, the easy one is precursors. You don't have
that. Yeah.
Do neutron star mergers, have they produced jets in simulations?
They've produced jets, relativistic jets?
Yeah. I mean,
I don't think that people do this.
Winds and outflows, they do.
Yeah. I think that jets essentially, just like with the long GRBs, you put them in by hand and you just see how they propagate.
Yeah.
But they have jets in simulations, right?
Well, but they more or less put them in by hand. I don't think they show from natural.
There are some jets that come out, at least that's what they thought. I don't know.
Are you thinking of the stuff that's shown in the
Yeah.
No, but that's different. That's a setup accretion flow around a spinning black hole. Your question is, can you make that system?
No, but I mean, that those are the same ingredients. This is not a making black hole, that is the stuff around it.
Well, you're asking after the black hole formed or before the black hole formed? I'm asking in the simulation. You see these beautiful movies of objects turning into teardrops, running into each other, spitting out all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a great question. You want to see the whole process, right? I mean, you want to see that you form a jet not because you started with a black hole and accretion disk. You start with two neutron stars that are in the process of merging, and at the end, you want to see a relativistic jet comes out in a natural. So those simulations do not exist.
Well, they do to some extent. Some of the things we are doing in the AI group, for instance, you do see once a black hole forms, if you actually follow the topology of the magnetic field.
Yeah, but you don't really see a jet, right? I mean, you see that this here, I think I have a...
It's for a jet, but not you can imagine all kinds of difficulties, like the accretion flow, the resulting fallback disk wasn't big enough, or the resulting disk wasn't large enough, then it won't collimate the jet properly,
sure.
Right? But these are the kinds of ingredients...
Yeah. So this is what Luis is referring to. So you can see these mergers, and there's some magnetic field structure that looks jet-like, but how much energy comes out here, and how collimated it is, and all these things.
And then everyone looks for the ingredients. What you were saying is it is sufficiently massive? So there appears to be no impediment to have it sufficiently massive. It's plenty of mass that gets flung around. In both cases, the black hole and the star, and the binary star. The black hole and the star is if black hole is non-spinning, and the mass ratio is not too large, then it gets harder. But the moment you put it in, it seems that all the right pieces are there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of this information will eventually come from LIGO, because one open question is whether black hole neutron stars even exist, right? I mean, they should, but we've never seen one, so you know, the formation rate of these systems is not known. Yeah.
But for the short GRB, should it be like the shape before the merger or
something? Sorry, should.
You just have the shape before the merger?
No.
No, after.
think we need to wrap up. Let's thank you again.